How's that? I don't even know if I need, oh, you need this for recording, right? Okay. I'd like to begin with the traditional homage to the Buddha, the Namo Tassa. Any of those that know it, please feel free to chant along if you wish. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed, Noble, and Perfectly Enlightened One. I believe one of the greatest things that I think I took away from and remember from monastic life of 20 years, from 1971 to 1991, 13 of those years were in Thailand and 7 of them were in Britain. We would usually meet every morning for what we call our after morning meditation and chanting. We'd have chores and usually meet around, I guess, 7 o'clock for a tea, maybe a light breakfast. And there would always used to be guests at the monastery. And in England, anyway, the kind of monks sat on one side and the nuns sat on the other side. And the kind of the senior monk or teacher would sit up at the front, and the guests would kind of be towards the back, but it was kind of everybody connected in this circle. And the whole breakfast or tea could be in total silence. And there's something very striking about silence, that there was permission to do that there, that one did not have to fill the silence. And I also believe that so much of our energy in our lives, in our everyday lives, is about filling the silence rather than noticing the silence or being a part of the silence. So certainly as I understand practice, meditation, mindfulness, that quality, that art of being present moment to moment, is being able to, I believe, pay attention to that silence. And so it's kind of like we always are trying to fill the silence rather than we more habitually go towards noise or agitation rather than towards silence. I think a wonderful example is we look around the room. If our eyes are open, I think most people's eyes are, what are we focusing on as we look? You're focusing on me, the speaker, or the person in front of you, or your peripheral vision, or the Buddha image, or the lights. So we're focusing on objects, but the objects are all contained in the space. So the space is much bigger and more inclusive and embraces really everything, but we focus on the kind of the details. You know, our eyes pick up, all of our senses, our ears, and so on. So I think it's a reasonable analogy for just in our minds, we're focusing more on the movement, the noise, the distractions, the kind of wanting to grasp, to hold, to cling on to something, to break. So there's almost, can be a discomfort in silence. Like a good example, like silence is like, you know, silence is like what you're not supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to say something, you're supposed to break it. It's like if you get on an elevator, you're supposed to turn and face the front. Maybe you've heard this story, but if you want to do something really weird and make people weird, you get on the elevator and just face everybody instead of facing the front. You're not supposed to do that. You know, when you get on an elevator, everybody usually turns to the door. But instead of turning to the door, you turn to face everybody and just kind of quietly stand and breathe and be mindful and smile. And the energy is quite dynamic. And so it's kind of like in that way, it's like being silent. Ajahn Chah used to always say, like as monks and nuns, we were like bells that had no sound. You know, so we were these bells, but nobody knew what we sounded like. We were never, you know, we weren't making noise, so there was no ring. So we didn't know, you know, one wouldn't know what the bell sounded like. So to me, that's a very refreshing thing, to be able to not be compelled or feel compelled to have to break the silence. Now, we do that on retreats because that's what's expected. We come in here and sit from 6:45 to 7:30. You know, all there's signs all around the sitting is going on and everybody needs to be quiet and don't make any noise and close the doors very quietly and, you know, all of these things so that those are the kind of the rules, the guidelines that we go around. So that's accepted, and it's accepted in a meditation center. But of course, then when we go out into everyday life, what we call normality, whatever that is, you know, we're expected to kind of fill the silence, you know, make our noise, make ourselves heard. Now, I'm not saying that in the context of that's wrong, bad, or should not be, but much of what I believe monastic community and monastic sangha has to offer is an example, a potential, a possibility for all of us. When one reads the history of the Buddhist teachings, and when Siddhartha, the Prince Siddhartha, was in the palatial kind of very heavenly royal existence, and supposedly his father had hid all of the worldly kind of discomforts and the kind of the negative signs of life, or the what turned out to be called, were what he saw were divine messengers, and we see them most every day, but there's four, and we usually only see three. So the first one was an old person, you know, decrepit, bent over. Those of us that are over 50 are starting to feel that more and more. And I know there's probably some here over 60, and you feel it a little more. And if you're over 70, even more. And then a sick person. You know, someone who has some kind of ailment. You know, anything from just a sneeze and allergies to a life-threatening disease. And then the third was a dead person. You know, a person that had died. That mortality was very obvious. So these three signs appeared to the Buddha to be, as the story goes. And so those are all kind of like a rather bleak picture. When we start to look between the spaces, we start to see these other things. We see that we're all getting old, that we all are subject to illness and that we're all subject to death. And we see that all around us, you know, whether we want to or not, it's there, it's undeniable. But the fourth thing that I believe is really missing in the world, and especially in our society, here is the fourth image. The fourth image the Buddha to be saw was a recluse, or a sadhu, or a bhikkhu, a meditating monk. So this was the fourth figure that the divine messenger that the young prince supposedly saw. And that raised even more curiosity, because in that lay the potential for liberation, for freedom, the way out. So the symbol is that of, and it's not necessarily saying that everyone has to relinquish the world and become, you know, monastic, a celibate, and live a very austere life, but it's kind of the indicator, the kind of the symbol of what is inspiring and what we can move towards to escape from or to more deeply understand our predicament of aging, illness, and death that we have inherited. Ajahn Chah used to say that we celebrate usually when somebody is born, we have a child, and there is a celebration. It's nothing short of a miracle. But he says, really, that's when we should start crying, because that's when suffering begins. He said it should be the opposite. We should cry at birth because of all that this baby is going to have to go through, and we're now big babies moving towards, you know, to be ultimately face our mortality. But when a person dies, at least in the physical realm, that the, you know, discomfort, the suffering of whatever that person experienced during life is gone. So that's kind of call for a celebration. So he says the world kind of always has it backwards. So if we contemplate that for a moment, whether we start at one end or the other, it's like, you know, having a complete picture. So in a way, our culture encourages us to have an incomplete picture, to only have little pieces of the picture. And a lot of the pieces that we see in, you know, television and ads and all of that are pieces that many of us have, you know, long since not maybe transcended, but see the foolishness or the direction that these things are kind of pulling us. But then we don't see the other. Where is the way out? Where is the inspiration? What is there to uplift the heart, the mind, the inspiration to be liberated, be enlightened, awaken. So the monastic community is that symbol. So in Thailand, where I spent my first years in the monastery, and even when I went from Vietnam as a GI and visited Thailand, that was very striking. Here I was, you know, I was getting high and drinking and chasing bar girls. And I was in the hotel one morning, and I'd woke up early, and I was looking out of the hotel room, and I see these kind of shaven-headed, wasn't sure if they were men or women, because when you shave your head, men can look very feminine and women can look masculine, or it's kind of an androgynous look that we see in a Buddha image. Often it can look both male and female, or not really have a sex, or have both sexes. So I saw these robed figures carrying something under their robes and just walking barefoot and silent, very peacefully and quietly, they just walk by, and wow, who is that? What is that? Mm-hmm. So it was just a very striking image to see that, and that happens every day, even today, even in the chaos of Bangkok. You go out into the countryside every day, you know, the monks and nuns walk through the village to, you know, with an alms bowl. This is a little big for an alms bowl. Mine was about this big, but I'm a big guy, so I could have a big bowl. But they walk, and the robe kind of encloses the bowl, and they always walk with their eyes downcast. So it's the idea of restraint and containment. And then people would say, Nimon Nikap, they would say, I invite you. So you would stop, you would turn, you would open the lid to your bowl, you would look into the bowl, they'd put whatever they had to offer, you'd close the lid in your bowl, and you'd turn and you'd walk on silently. Every monk would do that, every person would put their little offering. There would be no thank you, There would be no acknowledgement. Sometimes in some villages, maybe the people wouldn't come and they might stop and do a blessing for the people. But normally, that wasn't expected. And the beauty of that is, like, say on this side of the street or this side of the village, you know, is more the wealthy side. So they give you nice sweets and curries and very tasteful things. But towards the end of the village, they were poor, so they could only give you just a little bit of rice and maybe, you know, a kind of a rotting banana or something that was not all that. So you're kind of like thanking the people that give you the nice stuff. You get down to the end and you kind of look at that with disgust. So the training, the discipline for the monastic is to be grateful for the offering, not its value or its kind of the judgment that you put on it, the like or dislike, but a kind of a neutral. You're grateful for a grain of rice, or you're grateful for, you know, a peanut butter sandwich or bread. That sometimes they'd always see Western monks, so they'd always think that all we eat is bread. So they'd always come out and they're very excited to give, oh, here's some bread for you. And the bread there was like Wonder Bread. I don't know when the last time you had Wonder Bread, but you don't want to try it again. And but to them, that was like, that's what we ate, so that was like really offering something great, because they always want to offer you nice things. You know, that's kind of the devotion and the faith. So in our culture, we don't have Dharma. We have a lot of charities and good organizations and causes that we want to make offerings to. I mean, we're inundated. And there's many, probably 9 out of 10 are probably genuinely good causes, or, you know, at least 80%. But, you know, how many of them are direct, you know, hand to mouth? Because that food you would put in our bowl, say in the Northeast in Ajahn Chah's monasteries, that food they would put in there, except for the rice, we would take everything out. It would go in then to be distributed amongst the community. But then we would take out the amount of rice that we needed for that meal, put it in, give the rest back, and then it would all go back to the lay community, and they would take it back, and they would partake of that, and then they'd come around and put. So there was this kind of distribution of food, so we'd be given, and then we'd give it back, so there's this constant kind of sharing. And the symbol for the monastic is the bowl would always be, generally would be empty, which I think is a wonderful symbol, because you can't, if you're following the discipline, you can't store that food up. It doesn't matter if it's overflowing, which sometimes it would. It would be, sometimes there'd be ceremonies, and you'd have to have all these people with these bigger bowls to kind of empty your bowl so people could keep putting food in. That was like everybody wanted to be able to give something. But all that food would have to be relinquished. And, you know, after you finish, you wash it, you take it back to your little hut, and you put it like that with its lid. Let it dry out, and it would stay empty until the next day, and you went out. It would go out and collect again. So the idea is a constant relinquishing in a very simple day-to-day existence. Now, I don't know about for you, but to me, that's that relevance, if you will, but maybe more the word is the inspiration and the symbol of that is one of inspiration and encouragement. I lived that. I chose to leave it. I chose to live it, and I chose to leave it. But it remains a very, very powerful part of my life. And I would not be where I am or who I am without that. But just like my Vietnam experience, I wouldn't be who I am without that experience. And we can all, when we reflect, think back on our lives, and each stage, each part of our lives has informed the next, and we kind of accumulate the wisdom and the knowledge, the positive and the negative, and, you know, it makes us who we are. So I feel a lack of that in my current life. You know, there's not, you know, monks and nuns are really far and few between. You know, even the Christian sense of monasteries that are actually in this country where we can go, they're around, but we don't see them every day. We may see monks and nuns or a person of the cloth, we say, but these days they, many of them, I don't know what percentage, but, you know, dress like everybody else. So you really don't know who is a religious seeker in that sense. Again, I'm not saying that kind of the us and them, they're doing it and we're not. But there's this, the beauty of the Buddhist monastic Sangha, as I have lived it, understood, studied, and practiced it, is there's this wonderful interdependent community. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about the interdependence of all life. And in that community, there's an interdependence. The monastic community would not have survived to this day, as best as we can make out. The monks and nuns that are in California now from Ajahn Chah's tradition, and any others that are wearing robes from the Buddhist tradition of 2,000 some 500 years ago, that lineage has been unbroken. You know, if it's been perfectly unbroken, we don't really know. But as best as we can make out from the lineage, the historical records and everything, that is a very similar form that existed in India over 2,500 years ago. That's quite inspiring when we think of what that, and the kind of the fundamental, or maybe the overview of that, is that you have people in the world working and living skillfully, practicing skillfully, you know, living skillfully in non-harming ways, and then you have people who have relinquished the life of the worldly, or they call the homeless, left the home for the homeless life, and they're making their contribution, so that the monastic community is offering food for the heart and mind, the spirit, if you will. The lay community, or the householders, people living and working in the world, are offering food for the body. But everybody has their responsibility of giving, sharing, dana, of sila, which is virtuous conduct by body speech, and then finally bhavana, which we used to say is contemplation or engaging in a contemplative practice, you know, a meditation, a daily kind of practice, or better, more than a, you know, an ongoing, a constant kind of practice. And so in that, there's no kind of boundaries between that. The responsibilities are the same. The giving of the lay community is to support the monastic community. Hence, you know, simple robes, a simple dwelling, medicine only when they need it. You know, so those four basic requisites, you know, food, shelter, clothing, and medicine, are tried to be kept as simple as possible. And many of us, you know, live that as best as we can. There's one very inspiring friend I have, and she's here this evening. It's Anne Soule. She's very much a kind of a, from what I know of her. Now, I don't follow her every day and know, you know, kind of how she is on the precepts and all that. But I know Anne is very conscious about, you know, how she lives, the products, everything that she uses. And to me, that's kind of raising our consciousness to say, be as mindful as we can of what we use, how we use it. Okay, but the other part of that is like, okay, well, you know, Anne's doing that, but, you know, Patty or Nancy or George or Peter over here, you know, they, you know, are not doing that. Well, you know, then we can kind of get into like, you know, the us and them, and, you know, I'm green and they're kind of like, you know, maybe semi-green or even a little purple or whatever. So, you know, everybody is living in the best way we can. There can be a trust in that, especially if we're joining together in a sense of communal aspiration. But I think it's also where it's harder, and where places like CIMC really feel a very, not only urgent, what's the word I'm looking for? I think a very fundamental need in all of us to be a part of something. What I miss the absolute most about monastic life is the community. And I have not felt that here. And that's not a criticism. I just have not felt that same connection that I felt in the monastic community. And hence I had a long talk with one of my brother monks this morning. I said, oh, how interesting, I'm giving a talk this evening about the relevance of monastic life today. I says, what's its relevance? He says, no relevance. And he was half serious. And I think that is a very fundamental human yearning, longing, a very primal need to feel a part of. So if we think about the negative signs of, you know, illness, aging, and death, we can see those as separate. Oh, she's old, he's old, she's attractive, he's not attractive, and all these things can separate us. But if we break down the barriers between self and other, then we start to see that we're very similar. You know, rather than seeing self and other, we just start to see, you know, self and everybody, you know, manifestation. You know, everyone is a manifestation of ourselves in various ways. These are contemplations, for me, that come from the monastic influence. Can I live them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? No way. I get caught up, you know, in my car and earning a living, you know, in road rage. Isn't it fun, you know? How humbling after 20 years as a teacher, as an ajahn, you know, to come out and be ready to strangle the first woman I'm with. Or 10 years later to be ready to run somebody over and, you know, wish that I had an M60 machine gun from Vietnam. Like, shocking. Shocking. But yet humbling. It's like, oh, welcome to the human realm. You know, because as monastics, you get to kind of live up on this pedestal. So everybody kind of reveres and elevates and all of that. And it can get very tedious and burdensome. Seriously. You know, you can think, oh, the adoration, you know, and you start to think that you're somebody, but really it's as you look, it's really a reflection of yourself. And, you know, that it helps you to create humility, but also it can kind of raise the standard that can be quite discomforting. I know when I first went to Thailand, and, you know, when you go in the northeast, they're the most, it's the poorest part of the country of Thailand, but it's also the most devout. Most of the great teachers, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Cha, teachers that, you know, many of you have heard names of, come from the northeast, you know, out of this kind of rural, very poor part of Thailand. But when you go through the village, they don't stand up. In Bangkok, they stand up. Now, granted, the streets are kind of dirty and everything. There's still people that might do. But in the village, they take their shoes off. In Bangkok, they may or may not, depending. But then they get down on their knees. Everybody just lines up on their knees, you know, and puts food in the bowl. And they don't look at you either. So the whole idea is kind of respecting the robe rather than the individual. So the individual may be very corrupt, but the robe is bigger than the individual. You know, the community is bigger than the individuals. So you're kind of revering the tradition, revering what it represents, what its symbolism is. So it's times like this that I'm reminded of what an honor it was to have lived that life. Do I long or yearn for it at times? Yes, especially when things are, you know, complex or a lot of discomfort or uncertain. Because there was something very reassuring about monastic life in its kind of daily routine. Even though you're supposed to be living day-to-day uncertainty, there was actually a lot more certainty in monastic life in countries like, you know, where you were, where people wanted you to be, because they were going to do their best to support you. So you weren't really worried if your bowl would get filled each day. You know, that wasn't really a concern, or whether the heating bills. I mean, it always kind of came through, and if it didn't, you did without certain things. So when I left monastic life, in many ways, it was as traumatic, if not more traumatic, because I had less going from monastic life in back into, you know, the world, you know, without any kind of savings or knowing what I do. And we all take those risks many ways. When we go through life changes, we go through a divorce, a breakup, leaving a job. But it's those transitional kind of periods and the uncertainties where we take that kind of leap of faith. Sometimes we take it, sometimes we're forced to take it, but where we learn, where we grow and become stronger. I believe that everyone should have the opportunity to at least have a period to be exposed to monastic life and visiting a monastery and staying in a monastery. And I'm not saying just Buddhist. Because there's some rich Christian traditions that are quite... Spencer, Massachusetts, there's a wonderful Trappist monastery. And I'm not sure if you can stay. I know you can visit. But it's an opportunity to kind of tap into something that has, that's connected to the lineage, that has this wonderful kind of unbroken connection. We would not have this center if it were not for dedicated, you know, women and men who have both devoted themselves to monastic life and supported it. So are we going to say that the monastics were greater than those that supported the monastics? No way. Because you couldn't have one without the other. It's just like, you know, to have a child, you know, there needs to be the conception, you know, of the male and female, you know, eggs and sperm. You know, that they have to come together. So the monastic form had to be formed by, you know, devout people that would support that, and vice versa. So it's like it's been this perpetual devotion, faith, inspiration in that community in life that has brought us the Dhamma, the teachings, this center, you know, all of the centers that we see. And you know, it doesn't really matter what tradition, there's been a lineage that has kind of followed that through hundreds of years. And to me, that's very special because, especially in our country here, I don't think have the same appreciation for antiquity. And I'm generalizing for sure, but I think in many areas, you take the younger generation today, a lot of young people are like not really aware of lineage. Like I'm a Vietnam veteran. You know, like I'm an ancient, like to me, I think of, the people think of me now as a Vietnam veteran as I would think of a World War I veteran. You know, that's pretty weird to think about that. I think of a World War veteran, and you know, if they're still alive, they're kind of like, you know, walking. But these young people, I'm that age as a Vietnam veteran, they think of me as like a World War I veteran. So there's like a disconnect, you know, a disconnect with that, with the history and things. So I think in that sense, and especially if we are here in this center, we're interested about, you know, what this center is about, what this image is about, what the teachers are here about, that it's worth our while, you know, to engage in some kind of study to understand that more deeply, you know, what that lineage is. And the community is so much about simplicity, about relinquishing, giving up. So if we had a test at the doctor today, you know, like a little, you know, maybe a breast, or like I had a mole recently that I had removed, was going in to have the stitches out. Before I went in the stitches, they called me and said it was malignant. So I had a malignant mole. So I had to go, instead of have the stitches removed, I had to have another big chunk of, you know, flesh cut out of me. Now, they could say that's so malignant, and I still haven't heard. You know, I'm not saying this to kind of dramatize, but they could say, all right, well, we thought it was only shallow, but we realize that that's kind of like everywhere. Your number's up. My number's up. Ajahn Chah used to say, this is not a glass. This is a paper cup. But if this was a glass, he'd say, Gao ni tag leo? Tag leo na? This glass is broken. It's already broken. But don't break it. This glass is already broken, but don't break it. But when it breaks, you know that was already broken. You know, this person is dead, but they haven't died. Don't kill them. But she's already died. If we see things, begin to see things in this way, and this is the reminder of the monastic community, because ideally they're contemplating these things every day. They should be. That's their job. You know. Now, whether they're all doing that, I can't say. I can only speak for this monastic and the ones that are close to me. But that's what they're getting paid for. And the kind of worldly sense. That's why people are putting food in their bowl. That's why they're giving them, you know, robes to wear. Why they're giving them money to support the monastery. It's the same here. People give, don, and make offerings because Larry, Narayan, Michael, And whether teachers here, that's their job. Their job is to be here as teachers, to inspire, and to be living examples, you know, of being in the world, rather than out of the world, but in the world as practicing Dhamma as best as they can. You know, that's how they survive. That's their livelihood. But in the monastic sense, it's like kind of like jettisoning as much as you can and absolutely simplifying. It's like streamlining. Since I've left the monastic life, I mean, I've got this kind of backpack now that's just, you know, it's as big as the building here, you know. When I was a monk, I just had a little backpack. Now my backpack is huge. You know, I have a mortgage. I have a lovely fiance. You know, we got a cat. You know, all of these things. And I love them all, you know. My cat isn't dead yet, and it's going to be hard if my cat dies. But it's my job to remind myself. But if I'm closer to the monastic community, that helps remind me even more. Because it's like another level. And I didn't want to say, you know, up here and down here. It's just another level or another context, another framework, paradigm, if we use kind of a modern term of it, of how we view and live in the world. The daily chanting that do, and I think they have chanting here at CIMC, they call the recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the three refuges. The Buddha as the teacher, the enlightened one, the Dharma, the Dhamma, as the teaching, the truth, the way things are, and the Sangha as the community of those that are living the Dhamma, and inspiring really for enlightenment, for Buddhahood, if you will. You know, we don't talk about it in the Bodhisattva sense, but really it's very similar. So that recollection goes thus. It says, they are the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well. Now, I like to replace the word have and are with are, because I don't like to think of like historical Sangha, like, you know, Milarepa and Ananda and Anuruddha and all these great, you know, disciples of the Buddha and moving through the air and doing all these magical things. I like to think of it as current text, you know, of present, you know, in the present. So they are the Blessed One's disciples who are practicing well, who are practicing directly, who are practicing insightfully, who are practicing with integrity. That is, the four pairs, or the eight kinds of noble beings, what that refers to in the Theravada tradition, if you were aware of path and fruit, the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the fully enlightened one. So when they talk about four pairs, there's both the entering on the path and the fruition of the path. So they speak it in two ways. And these are the Blessed One's disciples. Such ones are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect. They give occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world. So think about us, you know, with our hair and our different styles and, you know, kind of the hodgepodge of humanity living in and around Cambridge or wherever we come from and whatever our background is, you know, are we living our lives that we're worthy of gifts and offerings? Does that mean no, people should be coming up and giving us things? No, but are we living in a way that is honorable, that has integrity, you know, that is respectful of ourselves and others? So these are not qualities that are just like, you know, unique to people that have relinquished, you know, the worldly life and living the life of a monastic. The last reflection is a really very powerful reflection. And I want to share it with you because I feel it's really kind of the essence. And these words are, you know, reputed to have come from the Buddha. And they're the what they call the 10 subjects for frequent recollection for one who has gone forth. So they talk about the going forth from the home life to the homeless life. They usually speak of it as the going forth, you know, going from the world, from the worldly life into the unworldly, or from the mundane to the super mundane. And bhikkhus, everybody familiar with the word? Bhikkhus is like the word for monk. Bhikkhuni is the word for nun. It really means one who is like a mendicant. One translation is a mendicant. One is dependent on others. Another translation is one who sees the one who sees danger in the world, in samsara, in the realm of birth and death, is another translation that sometimes is given. Bhikkhus, there are 10 dhammas which should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. What are these 10? I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. My very life is sustained through the gifts of others. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I should strive to abandon my former habits. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Could my spiritual companions find fault with my conduct? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I am the owner of my kamma, or karma. I am born of my karma, related to my karma, abides supported by my karma. Whatever kamma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who's gone forth. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Do I delight in solitude or not? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Has my practice borne fruit with freedom or insight, so that at the end of my life, I need not feel ashamed when questioned by my spiritual companions? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Because these are the 10 dhammas to be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I'd like to end this evening with the Buddha's words on loving kindness. I don't know if you may know it in English, but I'll do it in English. If anybody does, if I stumble, you can kind of like. This is a wonderful chant. This is the chant that historically is handed down if one was to go into a strange or perhaps unfriendly environment, both in the kind of the energies, the forces that may be in this area, or in, you know, more physical sense of the people that may be around in the area or that may kind of be unfriendly in any way, is to kind of establish the intention and the clarity and the purity, if you will, of heart and intention of wishing no harm upon, you know, any living being, seen, unseen, as you'll see the chant goes through kind of every imaginable manifestation of things that that arise and pass away. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with their duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the wisest thing. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for taking the time out of your lives to be here this evening and share this evening with. คนไทยหรือเปล่าโน no. คนไทยไหมโน no.
ปัดกินข้าว
หืมI've been blowing a lot of hot air around. Now it's your turn. At least warm air, I hope. Remember, the only foolish question is the one not asked. Please.I mean, I think there's different ways to answer that. I was in my conversation this morning with my close, monk friends, we were, talking about that very thing. And I think that, we live in a time of great, unrest and impatience. And although I think people... I believe very strongly that everybody is searching, to find their kind of connectedness to themselves and to the rest of the planet. That I think there's so much agitation and distraction. Thinking about all of the technology and everything that we have created, and many of these things are to take us out of ourselves. So if we just take this culture, how much, other than a mirror... it invites us to look at ourselves in a deeper way. A mirror image is just, our faces, our hair, or, whatever we look at as far as our physical form, clothed or otherwise. But other than that, there's not really a lot in our culture that encourages us to, look inwardly, or even that there's the possibility of looking inwardly. And as I've seen it over 30 plus years since I first was exposed to monastic community, that one could see it was never something that was meant for the masses, but it doesn't take thousands and thousands to keep the tradition alive. There's a handful, relatively speaking, but just like here, the people that came this evening. Now, I know I'm not that well-known a name here at this center. If it had been Larry or Joseph or Jack Cornfield or somebody, it would have been packed out. Point being is that, even as packed as that might be with somebody that's known compared to the bigger, community, out there, it's still relatively small. Yet it is an energy and a certain momentum. So I think it's partly the exposure and the realization that that's a possibility, and I think it's also that even if it was there, it's like we come to things in our own time. So when I was 18 and graduating high school before I went into the military, and even when I was in Vietnam and I went from Vietnam to Thailand, my first trip to Thailand, when I went into a temple, into a Wat, they call them, W-A-T, in Bangkok, It was gorgeous. You know, there's these little canals and all these, you know, mangy dogs and cats, but they all live there and they all get fed, and there's turtles in the ponds there and all these beautiful flowers and all this traffic and pollution outside of these temples. But inside, it's just, it's got this peace. And of course, there's a lot of vegetation in there, trees and stuff, because they won't harm that. That's kind of protected. It's a sanctuary. So even in the midst of that in Bangkok, it's like this peaceful kind of refuge. I remember when we'd walk out to collect food, come back into the monastery, I was just like this, you know, it just felt so good. But when I went there as a 22-year-old soldier from Vietnam, I had shivers in my spine, up my spine, when I thought about to live in that context. It totally freaked me out. It was like I thought of it as a prison. Less than a year, within a year, 18 months, I was back at one of those same places. So I wasn't ready at that time, but the seed was planted. And 18 months later, something ripened in me that's 20 years later, when I left and went back after a year of having left to Amaravati in England, sitting out lunching with a friend. You know, my hair hadn't really grown out yet. Sitting there eating and looking around the monastery that I helped establish and build for over 3 years at that particular place, I had another shiver. It's like, geez, how did I live like this for 20 years? I couldn't believe it. You know, so we change, we transform, but I think if we, you know, are open to it, the possibilities, then we just never know what those possibilities may be. So it's certainly, you know, we're not seeing it in popularity in that, you know, everybody's signing up like, or, you know, turns on the soap or Dr. Phil or Oprah or whatever it might be. But I really believe and see that there continues to be a support and things for that. And I don't think it's meant to be. One funny story, just to kind of end your question. When I came with Ajahn Chah in 1979, turned out to be his only visit to this country, the second visit to England. We came to IMS, and they had a retreat in his honor. And then we went out to the West Coast, Seattle, where I grew up, and stayed with my family for about, I guess it was about a week. And we were visiting a Thai community there that invited us to offer us a meal and everything. And Ajahn Chah was talking, and these were Thais that were very intellectual, had studied at university there, so they were much more, you know, thinking in kind of Western context. And Ajahn Chah said, in the old days, he said, in Thailand, you know, men would become monks for, it was part of their initiation into you know, maturing as a man to be a responsible person in society, to be, you know, a family man, a husband, a father, all of these things. It was considered something that they would do. They would have to do as part of a custom, of a Buddhist custom, and part of the cultural tradition. And he said that often they would come in and, you know, 2 or 3 months, and all of a sudden, you know, the monastery would start looking better than, you know, wife and kids and all the rest of it, and they'd stay. So this Thai man is there, and he was like shaking his head, and he says, Master, he said, what if everybody did that, you know, who, you know, how do we get fed? You know, so he's kind of like thinking, like, you know, if everybody became monks and nuns, I mean, who's going to run the world? And Ajahn Chah started laughing like he always did. He'd laugh, and he always had, you know, a spontaneous answer. He said, you know, laughing away, his big belly laugh. He said, you're thinking like an earthworm, he said. You know, earthworms dig the earth and keep pushing it up, afraid that they're going to run out of earth, he said. He says, "That's the you're thinking like an earthworm."
Like that, it doesn't lend itself to
But I think that really, I mean, I think that's a very, you know, Western psychological concept, and that in many ways it goes against our humanity. When I contemplate that really quite deeply, I think that, you know, I want to be independent, yet I want to be dependent. I mean, for me, monastic life, I could have not lived like the Christian idea of going off into a cell and just, you know, sitting there in a quiet room by myself, like solitary in a prison, you know, like solitary confinement. I would have gone mad. You know, I wouldn't have made it. I was able to live monastic life because I was able to kind of blossom as a person and develop certain skills, contribute to the community. Everybody meditated and practiced, but there was, you know, we lived life. You know, there was work to be done. There were things to be built. There were things to be maintained and cared for. And, you know, just like in everyday life, you had to wash your robes, you had to bathe, you had to go to the, you know, all of these things. And it was all part of a community. And so even though in Thailand it was more emphasis on solitude, you know, individual solitude, there was always the kind of the communal connection. In England, I loved it even more because then it was much healthier, I found, because we had you know, nuns in a more equal sense, as well as exposure to Western women who were much more, they weren't like, you know, Asian women, especially Thai in the Buddhist tradition, would be very much like, you know, not to look at them. For me personally, that even made women more attractive when they kind of were hidden. And it's like, you know, if you want to really desire something, you know, deprive yourself of it. Like, I'm not going to have ice cream for a month. And you're like, at the end of the month, you know, you'll be ready to eat, you know, 2 gallons of Haagen-Dazs or Ben and Jerry's or whatever. You know, deprivation is like, until you look at what that desire and that drive kind of is. Yes?
I wanted to ask, since you have obviously had the experience of being in a horrific war, and then have experienced the deep peace of monastic practice and so forth, I'm personally finding it difficult at the moment to get into the right place vis-a-vis the people who have taken us to war and so forth. Finding it hard to forgive.
I struggle with that too. You know, I have a lot of trouble of embracing George Bush and Cheney and the rest of them. For me, it stirs up, I deeply believe, something very primal, very old, like lifetimes old. The deception, what I believe is the deception, the corruption and all of that. And the only thing that I've found to give that bigger space is that everything is exactly as it should be. That, in other words, everything is happening for a reason. So karma, come in its truest sense, is cause and effect, in that everything is ripening conditions. As long as we're in samsara, in the Buddhist cosmology, as long as we're in cause and effect, we're going to be experiencing cause and effect, rising and passing away of all sorts of phenomena. The weather, the planetary changes, and of course, the most confusing and complex. I mean, nature is pretty simple compared to, you know, what human beings are doing. If I can step back and give it that bigger perspective and know deep down, you know, really know, and that takes, I think it takes a certain surrender and a willingness to kind of take a leap of faith, because if one doesn't know it from a deeper insight into the workings of karma, you know, the rise and fall, and that everything is happening according to cause and effect. I think the catch, there's another word I want, but the I think what where we lose sight in karma is if, say, if we accept, just take a, you know, we take the premise that everything has is cause and effect, like certain seeds, certain actions were planted, and these are the results, the fruits of those actions. Okay, you know. But then it's like, but what are the causes? That's where we get into trouble. Certainly where I get into trouble, and where I free myself, because I know I'm not going to know those causes. So in other words, Bush is supposed to be president. How could it be otherwise? You know? Because we can go back and second guess, and if they would have recounted in Florida, and you know, or if Nader had, you know, there's so many manifest, yet he's there. So if we can accept, just as a contemplation, that he's there for a reason, then there's other things that are bigger than that are happening for a reason. Just like when something happens to us, we talk about a blessing in disguise. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that George Bush is a blessing in disguise. I don't go that far. And forgive me if there's any Republicans here, or any Bush supporters. But that it allows me a way of content. And the thing for the last talk, I think I did it on the five themes for frequent recollection. And this is a wonderful contemplation, and this helps as well. And this is one of the things for frequently reflected on again by one who has gone forth. Beings, or all people, all beings, are the owners of their actions, heir to their actions, born of their actions, related to their actions, abide supported by their actions. Whatever actions they do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. So in the most profound and deepest sense, nobody gets away with anything. They just don't. Now, that's partly belief, but it's partly, so how could it be otherwise? You know, if cause and effect is true, you know, and there's constantly cause and effect, then things have to play themselves out. Now, I hope I'm around when, you know, those things are catching up with certain individuals. I won't mention any names. But that's my own spin. That's my kind of revenge. It's my smaller, you know, self that wants to see that, you know. But even like you take a Hitler or a Bin Laden or whoever that are made out to be really evil people, and from what we can make out, they are. But yet in their own convoluted way, can't think of his name, Bolozov, in We're All Doing Time, a wonderful book for inmates that was made available years and years ago, talked about, you know, that in his work with inmates, that, you know, if you couldn't embrace the most, what you would call the most, you know, heinous crimes, you know, against humanity, if you couldn't embrace that as a part of yourself, then, because that's a real challenge of our compassion, you know, how can you, and this is where we can justify the death penalty and all these other things that we all have, you know, feelings and views and opinions about, and yet, you know, how can any of those things, you know, justify certain other things, and yet people in their own convoluted way, I always think there's one thing in there, he talked about one inmate who was just really violent and killed a lot of people, but he brought out this, he drew, it's in the book, just beautiful artwork, and in that work, and he was eventually stabbed by fellow inmates, you know, so his stuff caught up with him. But he was actually getting Maury, I think it was, wasn't it? And you remember the one in We're All Doing? Anyway, he said, you know, even Maury, it was his way of trying to find love. He was killing, you know, if you kill somebody or if you harm in some way, it's you can't, if I plunge a knife in my heart in front of you, you're going to feel it, aren't you? You know, if I slap myself, you're going to feel it. If I show you a little scar where I had a little, you know, cancer on my lip removed, you look at that and say, oh, you know, you could feel that because my lip is no different than yours. You know? So it's like breaking down, you know, the barriers. The, you know, karma reflection I find is very good, just giving bigger space. And then the other is like, for me, just to look at how much discomfort and pain it causes me to be angry and want to harm people, whether it's, you know, on the road with aggressive drivers that I'm learning to have patience with, to what I see on the NewsHour or listen to on NPR, it's very, very hard because there is a lot of injustice. And yet in that bigger picture, certainly from the history of these teachings and I think Eastern teachings, that everything is happening for a reason. There's cause. There's something bigger than you and I going on. So if we can get into that biggerness, I say about my practice, I say, how do I know if my practice is progressing or not progressing? It's if I can't embrace something, if I can't bring something closer and open my heart to embrace it. So it's kind of like being able to hug, give a hug bigger and bigger. You know, how big can your hug be? You know, is it limited just by who you can put your arms around? Or in your own heart and mind, how big can you get? How much can you actually embrace? And that's, you know, of the heart, of the deepest part of ourselves, to be able to, you know, open to that and see in even the most convoluted, perverted, whatever way, that this has a place as well. And that's where, you know, like the Dalai Lama, you know, like true compassion, being able to forgive the horrendous things that have been done to the Tibetan people. But I haven't read, but I've certainly heard from him that, you know, he acknowledges that there is a national karma, as that were. That's happening to those people, you know. Jewish people, that happened for a reason. Now, it's not a belief, it's what I believe. It's just not haphazard. But we always get into, the problems arise when we start to kind of get caught up in the details and the injustice and the little, it's like 60, 70, 80 years old, you know, 80 plus, 90. That's been a long life. You hear, oh, your mother died at 91, your father just died at 90. We usually say, oh, that's too bad. We say, well, that was a good life. You know, 90 is a good life. Even 85, even 75, 80. That's a pretty good life. I lost what I was going to say. Yeah, but there was another point I was wanting to make. I lost it. What's that?
Getting caught up in the details?
Yeah, it may come to me. Don't worry about it. But that, you know, so we're able to, you know, accept that. This wasn't the point, but yeah, somebody younger, it's harder to accept somebody at 25 or that's a stillborn or something. And yet, those are the conditions that, you know, surrounded that person. You know, that entity, that being, and so on. But I think it was something on the, you know, on the details, and we want to, you know, we always want to know the kind of the particulars, and yet if we can get bigger with it, then I think it's less suffering for us as individuals. And that's not caring. To me, that's even more caring, because we start to then be able to embrace and get bigger with the things that are going on. And that's a great challenge. It's a great challenge. I find it very hard when somebody comes storming up behind me. I'm already going 70 with the flow of traffic. I can't go any faster because somebody's in front of me and somebody comes charging up at 80 and, you know, is one car length away from me and, you know, impatient for me to move and I can't move. You know? I won't tell you what it brings up. But I'm learning to acknowledge that, and there's no point. There's absolutely, I suffer. They're not suffering. So the best thing I see in mind, get out of the way, I get out of the way and just, I don't even look anymore, you know? And it's so much simpler, you know? It's so much simpler. But it's something primal, you know? I didn't get confronted with that in monastic life. So part of me leaving monastic life, that was a question in with any of you, was I knew deep down there were still things I had to resolve outside of monastic life. But I could not be here and be resolving in the way I am without those 20 years of monastic life. No way.
Thank you. And you experience it of, you know, when you were 20-some-year-old versus the 20-some-year-old you experience now, how
you mean when I think back on when I was younger?
Yeah. How do you think they are fundamentally different in terms
of... Oh, you mean that person and the person that's sitting here now?
No, I mean the young people you experience now.
Are they different? You mean that generation kind of? Or
well,
I'm not quite clear.
Yeah, inside, how do they feel different?
People in their 20s these days?
Yes. And well, also, I'm referring to this, the way things work now is society is much more divisive than they are, than it is community oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And what advice, what vision, or what specific thing would you offer to make it more community oriented?
Well, you know, I think a very simple plan, if you will, is, you know, each of us being responsible to break down the barriers between self and other. And other is everything other than self that we see as other. But if we break it down, in other words, if I, in whatever way, start to break down any barrier that I feel. So if I say George Bush, that's a big one for me. Between me and him, you know, I don't even want to identify with him. But there's parts in me that, you know, is kind of probably like him that I don't want to recognize. So if I can break down those barriers, even in the smallest way, it helps in my own heart and for me to create a more communal feeling. But bigger than that, I truly believe that that creates, you know, more harmony in the world. It's kind of like we can say that if I only eat what I need, okay, instead of going out and having to give extra food to people, if I only take what I need in my own way, I'm making more available for others in one sense. So it's like, you know, I think first and foremost being, you know, responsible of what I can do, how I can take care of it, and how I can be more, you know, open and kind and, you know, not those qualities that I do detest, being divisive, being, you know, impatient and you know, unkind in any kind of way, like the chant, you know, harboring any thoughts of ill will, of anger, you know, towards, you know, anybody or anything. But also for young people, yeah, I don't know, I'm sure a lot of you notice here as you get older that, you know, 20 looks younger and younger. Like my sister, this was about 10 years ago. She's just 51. It was probably 10 or even more, you know, and there was some young patrolman out for something in her neighborhood or whatever, and they came to the door for, you know, to ask her about something or whatever, and she was, you know, she said to me, she says, I wanted to say to them, do your mother know that you're out tonight? She says, I knew I was getting older when that. But I, you know, there's everything. There's, you know, like I worked at Cambridge Range and Latin for a couple of years doing, you know, mindfulness training, awareness training in the classroom, you know, with high school students, mostly bilingual. But I mean, all the shapes and sizes, and yet there, you know, I see all the quirkiness and the way they're dressing and all of it. But in my heart, I could have a space for, they're going through their own struggle to find their own identity. You know, when I was their age, I was doing my old weird things. You know, it wasn't, you know, the hair was this way. It wasn't piercing. But, you know, when I was a senior in high school, I was a football player. So the coolest haircut was what we called a rake. Does anybody know what a rake is? It's probably very West Coast as well. A rake, like this is really cool. This is a football player had a rake. So there was like almost bald here in the front. Everything else was kind of shaved like a marina. But it shaped down, like, so it kind of went up. Not real high, just enough. So if you had a cool head, you know, this rake look, you know, you look like a kind of a ram or something, you know. And cars had rakes on them, like 56, 57 Chevys. You know, they had a rake on them. So, and the, you know, the front end's like that and the back up's in like that. And it was just like so cool, you know, when you were in high school. So your hair was kind of like this car, you know, a rake, you know. But then there were the greases too, which is the long kind of bro cream and all that kind of hair. So anyway, remember bro cream? If anybody can remember bro cream, please raise your hand. My father was a barber, so I even knew more about bro cream. Please.
I'm a new student. And philosophy and approach to living. And, for example, you know, it's said that in life there's pain, but suffering, that's self-imposed. And that's a very alluring idea that I hope to explore soon. But anyway, my point is, so with this very cup-half-full approach, I notice these contradictions. For example, tonight in the loving-kindness recitation, you ended with something like,
being freed of all sense desires and not born again into this world.
Not born again. You know, if you're lucky, you're not born again. And the other example, when a child is born, we should cry because of all they have to endure versus the opposite. So I don't know how to integrate.
Well, I mean, I think life is a paradox, and certainly Buddhism brings up a lot of, like, you know, we take the teaching of anatta, not self, you know, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three characteristics of all conditioned existence. Anicca is usually translated as impermanence or transient, unstable. There's an instability in all conditioned things. They're changing. The second is that inherently they're unsatisfactory. And if you cling to them, then they're more than unsatisfactory. They can bring about pain and suffering. These are characteristics of all conditioned existence. What is a condition? Everything that we see, feel, touch, think about, see, is a condition. A condition, in other words, being composed of elements of things, something that arises and passes away. You know, everything in here are things that are arising, coming to manifest, but they're going to eventually pass away. This building will eventually crumble. You know, the planet itself, we hear about history and stuff. So that inherent change, in the biggest sense, is everything is on very shaky ground. It's like built on sandcastles. Yet it looks stable. This looks really stable. You know, I can hit it. It makes a sound. It's hard. If I hit it, it hurts. You know, but if we get the right amount of heat, you know, it totally collapses. You know, and if you throw it into the ocean and it, you know, kind of whatever shape, when it gets cooled and it falls down, the salt that it breaks up, it's then, you know, an oyster, or, you know, becomes a pearl that somebody wears in France or whatever. That change. The last one, anatta, without self, is contradictory and a paradox, because in one sense, before one can contemplate not self, you have to kind of understand what is self. Or in other words, have a certain stable identity. Like, I think back in the early years of monastic life, and even in England, that could be a dangerous teaching. Dangerous in what way? Dangerous in that people that don't have the psychological stability about, you know, who they are, their identity. And I had that myself. I had a lot of emotional instability when I left monastic life. So I went in emotionally, in many ways, very immature and unstable. But I became a rock in monastic life in that context. But then I came out after 20 years like, you know, super monk, but I was like, you know, wimpy man, because I, you know, emotionally, there's a lot of things that hadn't. You know, the first woman I was with, you know, and, you know, I won't go into details. So there needs to be a certain stability before you start taking that on. You know, so it's like, well, don't worry about yourself because you don't have one anyway. Yeah, that could be really weird and overwhelming. So kind of everybody at their own pace. So yeah, there's paradoxes, but you know, it's not saying what's important. I think when we hear things, is we take it on, we kind of tape it in our own way. You know, remember what we remember. We contemplate it, and we like wrestle with it, whatever, and, you know, what can we accept, what do we not accept, what do we kind of hold in that place of suspended judgment? Okay, yeah, that's, I can see that, where a baby is born, it all begins, but also there's this other side. I'm a woman, I'm a mother, maybe you're a mother, you've had children, maybe you haven't, but it's like the miracle of that. I mean, you know, a man cannot even imagine, you know, what it's like to hold, you know, a being and have it grow inside of you and then give birth to it. I mean, it's like, you know, there's no analogy that works for a man. You know, there isn't. So, you know, that kind of instinctual kind of connection to that and everything, it's not saying that it's wrong or it's, you know, or that it's not to be celebrated. It's an absolute miracle. But it's also saying, it's like, but, you know, that is the seed for the rest of it. So let's get the whole picture here. You know, it's not just baby born, lovely, oh, but then, you know, the diapers and the changing and the crying and the long nights and having to feed and then the periods of growth and struggle and all that. But we bond, we get closer, we learn, we grow ourselves. You know, we go through this whole process. And at the end, you know, we have some kind of deep experience and connection, which has helped us to grow and everything in whatever way. You know, I haven't been a parent, but are we always holding the bigger picture? Because what guarantees death? What guarantees death? Birth. Or life, yeah. You know, life and it's, you cannot take. Now, in our Western psychology, that is like, oh, you know, that's pretty negative or bleak or whatever. In Eastern tradition and in Buddhist, it's like, what are you, some kind of nutcase? You know, how can you deny that that's part of life? You know? Like I had the old folks in the village that supported the monastery when I was in Thailand. This one guy, they had to, you know, wheel him up in a little cart that they carried water and stuff with, or the buffalo dung or whatever. They'd be able to come to the monastery one more week. Come wheeling in and come crawling in or on the crutches or whatever and come over and bow to me. Could barely kind of, you know, make just a couple little humble bows. And I'd say, "You ain't dead yet? No, I thought I was going to go yesterday, but, you know, I made it to the monastery one more day. Oh, great. Yeah, you know, probably tomorrow." Or, and it's like totally like, you know, when are you getting married? Or when are you, it's like, it's such a healthy attitude to that. So, you know, in those paradoxes, a lot of them, I think, are created through our conditioning perceptions, you know, of these things. So it's not, and it's always interesting when we hear a talk, you know, from, you know, a Buddhist teacher and meditation and everything. There's always these kind of, you know, it's one way, and then it's, you know, not that way. Or there's always kind of, you know, contradictions. But I think that the end of it, especially when we're just beginning, it's like, never feel, or if you do, know that you're the one that's compelling that and no one else, hopefully, that, you know, if you feel, you know, that you have to kind of embrace something you're not ready, that's totally against, really, certainly my experience of what Buddhist teachings are about. It's like you're going at your own pace, and something that you can't embrace yet, you put it to the side. What can you embrace? You know, this is what brought you here. So you go with that, and then, you know, you take big steps, you take baby steps, you take 2 forward and 10 back. It doesn't matter. Everybody, you know, needs to go at their own pace. But questions are important. Challenge, question. That's the beauty.
The thing that questioning is the conclusion that the ultimate is to not come back to this life. That doesn't seem balanced, you know, with birth, of course.
Well, the other thing to remember and keep in mind, again, you and I are existing on the kind of the mundane plane. Now, we can imagine what, you know, enlightenment might be. We can imagine, you know, what, you know, not to be born. But so much of our conditioning is dependent on, you know, what we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think about. In meditation, in mindfulness practice, when we sit down and we say, "I'm going to sit here for 20 minutes and not move," we're challenging all that kind of conditioning. And we say, we're going to look a little deeper. We're going to go behind that. We're going to, you know, open up to other possibilities and potential until that agitation from the senses and the internal chaos, for sure, starts to settle. It's not until then do we begin to see, you know, that bigger potential. So if we think of it, you know, it's like God. You know, God is a word that is probably one of the, you know, it's like love. You know, I love hamburgers, you know, and, you know, and I love my, you know, my sister and mother and my fiance and other things like that. But, you know, is it the same love, you know, that I love something to eat, that I consume, that I do for a person? So that word is misused. You know, in the same way, when we think about, we kind of use words in the limited context of our human experience. It's like the 60, 70, or 80 year. That was what I was saying earlier that I forgot about. It was the snapshot of a life. And it's okay, bam, you take a picture. Boom, I take a picture of you. You're frozen in time, forever in that picture. As long as that picture lasts, there you are. How much of that is you? How much of it is just a freeze moment in time? You know, you look, oh, that's a horrible picture of me. I look terrible. I felt terrible that night. My hair wasn't on. I didn't have makeup on. Oh, it's a horrible picture. You know? And I take another one. Oh, yeah, that's a nice picture. That was 10 years ago. You know, that was really, you know, whatever. It's like a lifetime. Boom, we take a snapshot. 60 years. Is that all there is? Is that all there is? You know, it's like what came before and what comes after. So in the same way, we are kind of contemplating things like the things you're talking about in a kind of limited perception of things. You know, we're putting those kind of mundane. So back to the word God, I don't like the word God because I think people try to personify. And when we try to personify, how can we personify anything other than maybe, you know, a perfect human being? What does that look like? Well, you know, they still fart and go to the bathroom and, you know, they're human. You know, so how can we create perfection in what we see as kind of imperfection? The beauty of Buddhism to me is that we don't have to get caught up in trying to define that. We talk about experiencing it, going to it. You know, everything is directness to us. And then once the experience is there, the most profound encounters I had as a monastic with other monastics, Christian, mostly Christian, but other kind of or spiritual religious traditions, when we, I think it was especially monastics, because there were so many similarities and parallels to monastic life, when we could talk, and through our dialogue, we began to break down the words and hear the experience behind the words. That's like breaking down the barrier between the Christian monk and the Buddhist monk. And I was like, whoa, then this, because you're opening to the experience. Does it change the experience that, you know, this was fizzy, you know, polar springs fizzy water, you know, and I give it to somebody that, you know, doesn't even know that there's such a thing as fizzy water and from Poland Springs, and they taste it, and I give them a name or I try to translate it, and, you know, to 10 people, it's not going to change the experience by what we call it. What's important is, you know, the experience of that thing. And that transcends. You know, and that therein, I think, lies a lot of the world's problems. Joseph Kappel for president. Seriously. You know, because we get caught up. And again, making the barriers rather than breaking them down, we keep creating, you know, more barriers. I'm getting the peace sign for man. I think that was either two more minutes or peace or time out. And we're just getting warmed up here. Look at them. They're like kind of getting going. Please. Last question, I guess.
Okay. The one comment, one question. You talked about, or you mentioned the boredom that, you know, could sometimes come up.
Did I mention boredom?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, you did.
Wow. I must be getting old. I don't remember that one.
What was interesting about it is, first of all, it made me think, I just recently read Tim Ward's book about what the Buddha never taught.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He goes on about boredom and that sense of certain emotion, too. But in a more personal experience, I found that in time, the intensive retreat experience that I've had, that boredom is an incredibly powerful force. And actually, without that boredom, nothing happens. You just wind up doing the same things you do all the time, only you do it without talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you really, you know, you get bored, so you start making up the stories about everybody you can't talk to.
And you start talking more than you ever did in your life.
You get bored with that, you shut up about it. This may be exactly what will happen for the entire rest of the time that I'm here. And, you know, whether it's my back is killing me, I don't feel like I know what I'm doing, blah, blah, whatever it might be. And that, having to just sit with that was really what was an incredible experience. So it's one of those, the many oddities, I think, of this particular practice that boredom is an incredible thing. I mean, once you really...
Yeah, it's energy, yeah, it's for sure, yeah.
The other question I was wondering is, the lady had asked about decline in numbers of monastics. I know that this is true for Christian monastics. I have no idea, I don't know that there are any reliable statistics. I've never seen any reliable statistics about Buddhists.
Cambridge, Harvard, we should get somebody on the project.
And particularly Western Buddhist monastics. Is it your sense that, say, you know, are there fewer people who participate in the various things for Western?
I just talked to Ajahn Pusano recently, who's a very close, we were monks together in Thailand for many years, and he goes back more frequently from the West than any other, and I, you know, stay in contact. I'm going to be seeing him soon. I know when I had a conversation the other day, he said that Wat Nanachat, which is the international monastery of the branch monastery of Ajahn Chah, is very near his main monastery in the northeast of Thailand. He said it was thriving. There were a lot of people there. But I talked to Ajahn Suchito this morning at Chithurst in England, and I mean, there's people there, but it says there's you know, I think a change from when I was there, you know, 91, so 13 years ago now, wow. That, I don't want to say the quality, these are my words, so I'm paraphrasing. It's like the kind of the, I guess the confusion and the lack of focus of people coming or the baggage that they're bringing. So I think it ties in to what I was saying and your question about, is it a decline? I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, there are no statistics, but maybe the depth, if you will, of the person going is not, you know, it takes a strong character and a healthy, strong character, you know, to go into monastic life and be able to give it 5 years. You know, it's one thing to go and say, well, I'll, you know, hang around for a month or two, or even hang out for, you know, a year. That takes a certain commitment. But when I left after 20 years, I said, when I first came, you know, I thought, when I met Ajahn Chah, you always used to hold his hand up. His hand wasn't very big, but each of those fingers meant a year, you know. So that was a pretty big hand. But I had a lot of faith in that. I said, this man knows what he's talking about. I'm going to hang in there 5 years. So after 5 years, it's like, wow, I'm just, you know, kind of got my nose skinned a little bit, you know. You got to definitely hang around until 10. You know, then at 10, I guess it was around 10 that I went to England. See, that would have been 7, you know, roughly 10 or 12. And then, you know, at 10, it's kind of like you're getting your feet on the ground and you're able to kind of maybe be of benefit to someone else and, you know, not be so neurotic. And then, well, if you're giving it 10, you know, 15, if you hang for 15, you should definitely give it 20. So that's what I said to people when I was leaving. I couldn't speak after 20, so. But it's like the, you know, the level and depth of commitment. But even a retreat, I mean, we're all at different. So to go on just to come here for a day long or a half a day or a sitting, you know, for someone is major. But, you know, that's where we start. And then you do a day long or you do a weekend or even to go out to IMS. And maybe you want to visit Emerald. Maybe you shave your head. But, you know, everybody's kind of going at their pace. And I think the key is that people are genuinely looking. There's enough people generally looking to keep it alive and keep that, you know, momentum and sense of, you know, peace in the world. that we so desperately, you know, need. So we need a lot of the, you know, bells that have no sound, you know, where people don't know what the sound of the bell is. You know? I love that analogy. He said, you know, we're sitting there together, and he says, turns to me, he says, you know, he says, we're like bells, and he says, don't make any sound. He said, you know, people see us, and it's just like, you know, it's a person, but what sound is this person? You know, their head shaving, they're kind of very restrained, and make some noise.
That was a very, very interesting sort of comparison, because the I remember when you said it before, my first thought that popped into my head is, what good is the bell that doesn't make any sound?
So, I mean, what good is boredom? I'm bored. Get me out of here. Great teacher, right? Well, thank you, everybody, for being here this evening. May you all awaken from forgetfulness and realize your true home. Yeah. Ah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.